So welcome to the Neuro Clinic. We have the pleasure of the company of Dr. Vaughan Bell. Vaughan, you are very welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I'm accompanied, as usual, by my co-host, Cleena Carroll.
Hello, everybody.
And I'm Ingram Wright. So Vaughan, we're going to start as we usually do in the Neuro Clinic. And I think you've kindly offered to introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. So I will indeed. So my name is Vaughan Bell. I'm partly an academic at UCL, where I lead the neuropsychology teaching on the doctorate in clinical psychology there. I also work in the NHS, and I'm partly based in a psychological interventions for people with psychosis clinic. And I'm partly based as a neuropsychologist in a neuropsychiatry clinic, both at the Maudsley Hospital in glorious South London.
Very welcome, Vaughan. Thank you for that. I think we've discussed some of the questions, some of the themes we're going to explore, and this comes on the back of a lecture you gave, which was, I think, designed to be provocative, or at least we had a conversation in the background about it being provocative. But on re-listening to it before this podcast, I'm utterly persuaded by your arguments that we need to think about what neuropsychology has to offer an understanding of mental health, but also individuals who have mental health problems, how services need to be reconfigured. And I think we'll make sure that link to that talk is available alongside the podcast. But we wanted to spend some time today sort of exploring some of those themes that you advanced in that talk. But it really helpful to understand how you got into neuropsychology. I think our listeners are often interested in hearing stories about how people got into neuropsychology. Could you tell us your story?
Oh, mine is probably the least interesting story, actually. So I wanted to be a clinical psychologist since I was 16. But it just turns out that what I had in my head of what a clinical psychologist was completely different to how it is, but it turned out well regardless. I went and did a psychology degree, which I found really boring. And it wasn't until the third year where we had a module on clinical psychology and someone handed me, rather predictably, Oliver Sacks' book. And I read that and went, brilliant, that's amazing. And then I got a job as a computer programmer after university and saved up and did an MSc and then worked for a bit and then got tricked into doing a PhD by my supervisors, actually. And I did a PhD on cognitive neuropsychiatry and then trained as a clinical psychologist. So it's I went to a Oliver Sacks talk and I took my book along and I was going to sit down and say to him, I'm a neuropsychologist because of you. And then someone in the talk to introduce him said, I'm sure we've all been influenced in our careers by reading Oliver Sacks' book, and virtually everybody in the audience nodded. So I think I'm one of many people who are a neuropsychologist because of Oliver Sacks.
Which book was it, Vaughan?
Oh, it was The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
I think part of my bookshelf has an entire Oliver Sacks collection, which is slightly embarrassing when people come to visit and you see this entire like homage to Oliver Sacks. So yeah, totally empathize with that position.
I'm sure many people have one, Cleena.
We have promised our listeners a kind of tour of Cleena's bookshelves, which are proudly displayed behind her, because you read a lot of books, don't you, Cleena?
A small selection, Ingram. Moving house with me is not a lot of fun.
We're going to get to that bookshelf soon, aren't we?
We will. We will.
I had a question, Vaughan, that I said, we're starting with one that wasn't on the list, but I remember in my undergraduate days, late 80s, early 90s, lectures on schizophrenia and psychosis that were looking for a sort of cognitive end of phenotype. I think some of the things that you're talking about, or at least talked about in your lecture about, you know, what a neurocognitive, neuropsychological understanding has to offer to mental health context and to patients. I suppose I wasn't particularly thinking of where the field has got to since the late 80s, but you think there's still an important strand of work around understanding cognitive features that commonly underpin conditions, symptoms like psychosis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important focus. I have to say progress has been really slow, particularly in psychosis. I don't think we have Actually, many even confirmed mechanisms, cognitive findings in psychosis. And actually, one of the most confirmed and replicable findings is not about mechanisms, it's about cognitive difficulties. So we know that people with psychosis, on average, have cognitive difficulties with memory, problem solving, concentration, in a real kind of neuropsychological area. And it's interesting that there's so much attention paid to mechanism, and in clinical work, so little attention paid to cognitive difficulties. I'm not suggesting it's completely ignored. There has been some good work, but it's amazing how much of clinical psychology does not focus on cognitive difficulties in psychosis, and is much more about people's kind of, you know, emotional and you know, adaptive struggles, which of course are really, really important.
Yes.
I guess it's interesting, isn't it? Because I guess in your position as an academic and a clinician, I can imagine that a lot of your work, Fawn, is thinking about the theory, but also the practice. What is it to sit in a room with somebody who is experiencing symptoms of psychosis, and how do you help that person? I just would be really curious to hear kind of your views of kind of that link between being an academic researcher, and I guess it's that theory practice link, which influences which.
It's a really interesting question, and I think they influence each other at different times and in different ways. And you know, you can sometimes more clearly see the lack of progress when you're a clinician, because you realize actually how some areas of research have had so little impact actually in kind of clinical areas. And then you can also see on the clinical side how many areas that people struggle with are not, you know, kind of, let's call them popular subjects of clinical research. So cognitive difficulties in psychosis, which are a massive predictor of people's difficulties with functioning, just get so much less attention than mechanisms, for example. And so you really do notice sometimes how we're not necessarily well equipped and well trained for some of the common problems we do see, which is partly why I've become more and more interested in kind of the lack of neuropsychiatric focus in clinical psychology and neuropsychology.
I wonder what your thoughts are on the why of that. Why is it that the research hasn't been done around cognitive symptoms? There's no right answer to that, is there? It's just a curious question.
I think there's a number of reasons actually, and some of it is that it falls uncomfortably between neuropsychology and clinical psychology. I mean, one of the interesting things about clinical psychology and neuropsychology is actually they come from very different roots. So clinical psychology was very much, you know, founded in psychiatric services and for the purpose of working in psychiatric services. And neuropsychology, this is particularly true in the UK, comes very much from brain injury clinics, the early work of Oliver Zangwill and Andrew Patterson. And there has been two very clear traditions that we still see in the way we're trained, which clinical psychology is very much for psychiatric difficulties, broadly conceived. And neuropsychology is very much for neuro-rehab. That's a lot of where the training is focused. And actually, there's very little formal attention for the big grey area in the middle, which of course is not a grey area for people who experience either psychiatric difficulties and have cognitive problems or associated things like epilepsy and things like this, head injury, which are very common, or folks with brain injury or neurological difficulties who also experience mental health problems. Then it's not a grey area for them.
Well, lots of questions come up for me, and we might track back and discuss the, I suppose, the lack of value, I suppose, you've seen in the sort of historical emphasis on mechanisms around what cognitive features might underpin people's experience of psychosis. What you're suggesting is a greater emphasis on understanding cognitive difficulties that are often associated with psychiatric conditions is helpful in guiding us towards effective treatments. Is that right? And if we don't get involved, or we aren't informed neuropsychologically, we are correspondingly diminished in our capacity to help, right?
I just clarify, I don't see a lack of value in research or mechanisms. I just think that it's be slow going.
Yeah.
Science is hard. You know, there were, I think, maybe 200 years before the mechanisms of the heart were understood and how that was applied to, you know, cardiovascular difficulties. And so, you know, science can be slow going. So yeah. I don't think it lacks value. I just think we've not made the progress that would be ideal. Yeah. What was the second part of your question?
Well, I suppose it was about what tools we have to understand neuropsychiatric presentations, mental health presentations. And I think your argument is that neuropsychology has a lot to offer in our understanding of how to treat chronic alcoholism. It has a lot to offer in our understanding of how to treat psychosis. It clearly has a lot to offer, perhaps conventionally, but there are challenges around epilepsy and mental health, around stroke and mental health. And I think your argument, as I understand it, is essentially that we need to bring more neuropsychology into that space in order to better treat patients. But I think what you're also saying is we also need to advance the neuropsychological science that might underpin our understanding of those conditions.
Absolutely. And I would say, and I realize the audience I'm speaking to, I think we also need to think more about mental health for folks with neurological disorders. Yes. And it's not that neuropsychologists are completely ignorant, obviously not. In the UK, neuropsychologists have all done clinical psychology training. But it is certainly still the case that people with neurological difficulties struggle to get support for mental health.
Yes.
And that neuropsychologists are not able as a profession to provide that help in the quantity that is needed. And it is also the case, I think, that we as a profession struggle sometimes to accept that there is some specialist knowledge needed for neuropsychiatric conditions that is not simply the experience largely focused on mental health we get as clinical psychologists, plus cognitive neurorehabilitation that is taught for postdoctoral training. And, you know, it's not that there aren't neuropsychologists doing excellent work in mental health. I've worked in neuro rehab. I spent quite a bit of time doing CBT for folks with depression and anxiety. But, of course, there is a whole field of neuropsychiatry of which appears very rarely in either clinical psychology training or postdoctoral neuropsychology training.
So the clear training question here, Vaughan, and it sounds like you value the fact that here in the UK, we would train as clinical neuropsychologists first and foremost in clinical psychology. Mm-hmm. So there is that kind of foundation. I guess what you're speaking to is the lack of integration in terms of how our yeah. practice is delivered, that we don't tend to synthesize our understanding of mental health and neuropsychology in a very effective way in terms of the way that services are delivered. I suppose I wondered how we might change training in order to address that. And you talked in your lecture about what clinical psychologists might need to understand that is essentially about neuropsychology and mental health. And you said, and I'm persuaded by this, that we don't necessarily want to teach clinical psychologists to be neuropsychologists, but what we do want to do is to place some emphasis on the neuropsychology that underpins mental health understanding.
Yeah, and it's less about mechanisms, actually. It's more about the sort of problems that frequently co-occur. So yes. I often do training to clinical psychologists in mental health services about, let's just call it neuropsychology, cognitive difficulties and things like this. Yes. And I ask people, how many people in your service do you see who have neurological problems? And very few hands go up. And then I ask, okay, how many people have epilepsy? And then a few hands. How many people have a history of head injury? A few hands. How many people have longstanding alcohol problems? And then kind of the penny drops that actually what are traditionally considered to be neuropsychological or neurological disorders are health disorders which are common and more common in people with mental health conditions, particularly at the more severe end, than they are in the rest of the population. And the we have this kind of idea that there are neurological patients and there are psychiatric patients. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, a lot of clinical psychology training, a lot of our documents in the BPS actually puts it in a more extreme way. It says there are people with understandable reactions to life events, and there are people with biological problems. And that if we frame things in terms of biological problems, we're less able to empathize, we strip people of meaning, and we undermine their autonomy. Now, I think this is a useful way of understanding certain approaches to mental health problems in psychiatry. But to be able to write that, you can't be keeping people with neurological problems in mind, because it is quite, it demonstrates some really quite troubling implicit beliefs about what it means to have, not a phrase I particularly like, but biological problems, neurological problems. And I think this is, you know, something we should be more aware of, because actually that is not a neat divide.
Yeah.
Most people with neurological problems have problems with mental health, and a vast number of people with problems with mental health have neurological problems, even if they're not primarily treated by neurological clinics.
Yes. It's interesting. I mean, in your lecture, you talk about the organization of services, and that anybody, even working in conventional neurology, neurorehab services, will come across people with prior history of mental health problems, co-occurring problems with alcohol and drug use and those kinds of things, and but might struggle because that space is a less comfortable space for them to operate in. I think what you're saying is we need to think about who our services are for, and maybe think about sort of our biases, both in terms of service structure and our orientation as clinicians. I've done some work around epilepsy and mental health in children, and I suppose I've been struck by the fact, and something you said in your lecture, which is that if you're a young person with an epilepsy and co-occurring depression, you can't get into CAM services because your epilepsy is seen as a confound that's difficult to understand. Equally, you get poor service in terms of the management of your epilepsy because of your co-occurring mental health problem. But it sort of struck me in terms of how we respond to that in our service organization. There will be some young people who have depression and epilepsy whose needs could be well served by perhaps a system in mental health that's better educated about how epilepsy doesn't have to be a barrier to accessing conventional treatments for mental health. But in some cases, it may be that there is a relationship between your epilepsy, dysfunction in medial temporal structures, etc., that it is characteristically linked to your mental health experience. And we need to understand both sides of this argument, don't we, in terms of how we organize services.
And you know, on paper, us as clinical psychologists and neuropsychologists should be really good at this, right? Because if we think at the core of the causal links between epilepsy and depression, of course we have alteration to brain circuits that are involved in the, you know, maintenance and modulation of affect. So, but we also have the the difficulties, the life events that living with epilepsy will cause. We also have stigma and discrimination that someone with epilepsy will experience. And we also have the fact that the same predictors, the same social factors that raise your risk of epilepsy, raise your risk of depression. And this is partly, something that I'm always surprised and a little bit shocked by, in that often our documents do make this clear distinction between, you know, problems which are reactions to life events and biological problems, which is a complete ignorance of the fact that social predictors are equally as important for neurological difficulties, for epilepsy, for brain injury, for, you know, a whole range of different disorders as they are for mental health problems. And as clinical psychologists and neuropsychologists trained in formulation, trained in complexity, and thinking about how to understand to what extent all of those factors maintain difficulties for a particular person, this should be something that should be front and center of what we do. And yet, you know, if you simply the link between epilepsy and depression, epilepsy being one of the most common neurological disorders, and depression, probably get a lot of clinical psychologists, neuropsychologists less perhaps, but a lot of clinical psychologists to really struggle just to give you a good account of the sorts of causal factors that link epilepsy and depression.
Yes.
It sounds from what you're saying, Vaughan, that it's very much going back to training, isn't it? And, you know, I guess you were talking about being the lead of the neuropsychology training at UCL. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your experience of bringing neuropsychology into a clinical psychology training course.
So it, I had to say it was already there.
Yeah.
I guess I can talk a little bit about my emphasis, which is I'm really keen that the neuropsychology training on our clinical doctorate at UCL is not designed for future neuropsychologists, because actually it's relevant to everybody, no matter what service you work in. And what I would like people to do is leave our training course, firstly, with that understanding that this is equally as important a skill in whatever place they, just like risk assessment, right? Nobody would kind of go through the clinical training going, yeah, risk assessment, just not for me. I didn't think it was particularly interesting or important. I don't want to work in it. So everybody knows it's a core and essential skill. And that's what I would like people to leave our doctorate thinking about neuropsychology. And of course, there are people who want to go into neuropsychology services. You know, I have a special candle for them because I work in neuropsychology service. But as someone who also works in mental health services, I would love someone to leave our doctorate going, do you know what? That was fascinating and important, and it's going to be useful. And I have no intention of working in neuro rehab services.
Yeah, I think there's something, isn't there? I guess just listening to you, I was thinking about that fundamental link between, you know, like to unpathologize it, like between our well-being and our thinking skills, our cognitive skills. Like if I'm tired or hungover, I can't function as well cognitively. And there's something, isn't it, that real fundamental understanding between these things are integrated. It's not like just people over there have this. And I don't know, to break into kind of psychodynamic thinking, like I wonder if there is this splitting that goes on between, well, if I put people over there in that category, then it's not, I don't need to kind of link with it in the same way or something. I don't know whether there's something just kind of the psychic pain of being around someone living with a long-term neurological condition that feels quite difficult for all of us and we want to distance from. That's a very far cry from the CBT thinking about depression.
This is part of the narrative which is central to our profession, right? So everybody has psychological distress. And actually, the psychiatric diagnosis are arbitrary distinction between, you know, mental wellness and mental health may be useful regardless. But, you know, I think, you know, saying it's an arbitrary distinction would probably be something most people would agree with. And therefore, the same way we can understand stress and distress in everyday life, we can apply usefully to people who have marked difficulties with mental health problems. We do not have that same sort of narrative or understanding for neurological, neuropsychiatric, and neuropsychological problems, despite the fact that if you have a good understanding, you'll understand that head injury lies on the spectrum, that seizures lie on a spectrum, that metabolic difficulties lie on a spectrum, that the impact of drugs and alcohol lies on the spectrum. And, you know, actually a lot of what we think of and conceptualize in clinical psychology as neurological disorders also lie on the spectrum. And that same approach, that same understanding that allows you to work with someone who has severe TBI after a road traffic accident is also useful for someone, for example, who's in mental health services and has experienced domestic violence.
Well, I suppose I was wondering whether this is a question of emphasis when it comes to treating individuals. So I often find myself in my pediatric practice seeing a family who have a child who's had a traumatic brain injury, you know, thinking about actually 80% of the time I'm using my skills as a clinical psychologist to understand the impact of trauma on the family, on their perceptions of the child's development, on their concerns about emergent behavior that might well herald something that they've heard could turn into something much more sinister later on, to offer reassurance, to offer psychoeducation, to offer guidance to that family in terms of framing their concerns, but very much about understanding a family who've experienced trauma. And I was struck by what you were saying about the professional stance we might adopt around formulation and the views on biological explanations. Is it just a question of emphasis that in some cases, if I seeing a young person with epilepsy and depression, sometimes it's about growing up with a chronic condition and understanding that, you know, you get left out the football team because there are concerns about you getting a bump on the head, perhaps erroneously, and you're socially excluded. And there's a story there, right? And it isn't harmful necessarily to emphasize that story in some cases, but where the story is about carbamazepine and your mesial temporal structures and your regulatory function, it's also important not to disregard that story in some cases. But it may well be that we can deliver services that does reflect a rather false dichotomy, but it's a dichotomy that's sensitive to the fact that balance will sometimes be on one side and sometimes on another. Is that a reasonable approach, do you think?
I think it's entirely reasonable. You know, I'm not saying that we should destroy the structure of our services. They're there for a good reason, and they evolve over time. But you know, if you talk to folks who have neurological difficulties or mental health difficulties, and if you look at the studies on unmet needs, yeah, they will. It's very, very clear that actually people's needs are not being met by a lot of the services. And this is not through lack of willing, this is not through, you know, kind of, you know, it's just the way services are structured and our training is structured, and actually the way that our profession has evolved in terms of understanding some of these difficulties, which means that actually some of the services do sideline some of the problems that people have. And, you know, it's not that people are kind of, you know, putting their fingers in their ears and things like this. They're often at a loss to how to support someone. And if you've ever worked in, you know, mental health services with someone with a neurological difficulty, or you've worked in the you know, neurological services for, and you've had the experience of trying to find someone a service that will accept someone and support them in a more integrated way, it can be very difficult and frustrating. But I think as professionals, what we can do is think about how well our own profession, in terms of the understanding, the training, and the way we conceptualize problems, actually allows us to support people ourselves, regardless of what service we work in.
And I think there's something, isn't there, in what you're saying, Vaughan, about resources, that it's, you know, it's a knowledge resource, it's an information resource in terms of training. But I guess I'm thinking, as you're talking about, you know, colleagues that work in mental health services where, you know, maybe they've, you know, they have somebody who comes along with mental health difficulties and they're thinking, this person has cognitive difficulties, I'll do a cognitive assessment. And actually the resources to do a cognitive assessment aren't in the test cupboard, or there's bits that have been there for over 20 years. And there's something, isn't there, about the resource available within mental health services to actually be able to consider someone's cognitive difficulties or how to manage that or adapt the therapy to support.
To an extent, I have to say, but I think this is one area, the specific example you mentioned, Cleena, where someone, a clinical psychologist working in mental health services, has concerns about cognition and is, you know, thinks that an assessment might be best, where I don't necessarily think it's always down to resources. Sometimes it's down to confidence and training.
100%.
And you know, actual helpful framing of something straightforward like a cognitive assessment in at the doctoral level. So, for example, I frequently am contacted by clinical psychologists, qualified clinical psychologists, and trainees who are doing a cognitive assessment. And one of the first questions I always ask is, what problem are you trying to solve? And it is amazing to me how often people struggle to answer that question. So what problem will your cognitive assessment solve? And, you know, people sometimes go, I want to find out whether they have cognitive difficulties. And I'll say, well, from what you told me, you probably don't need to do an assessment to assess that. Yeah. It's very clear that they do. So what would be the, and actually it's a, there are lots of different problems you can solve by doing a thorough cognitive assessment, right? Sometimes it can be a, to what extent are the person's self-reported difficulties in memory and so on supported by, you know, neuropsychological problems, to what extent, and there are other more complex ones, to what extent might different things be causing these cognitive problems and so on and so forth. But the fact that we train on most clinical psychologists, I would say, leave clinical training having had the experience of physically delivering the test, calculating the results, but with often little understanding of what that assessment is useful for, what problems it can solve, and to a certain extent, the ability to formulate. And, you know, if you... formulation is a never-ending skill that you develop over time, and it will, so you can't expect everybody to, you know, be able to perfectly formulate the kind of cognitive trajectory of someone who's had lifelong epilepsy and alcohol problems and things like that. It gets kind of, you know, that requires a lot of background knowledge that isn't going to be taught on, and that's not such a bad thing, but being able to formulate reasonably kind of standard stuff, like to what extent do the numbers that have come out of this test reflect the likelihood of them having neuropsychological difficulties, which are adequately measured by this assessment? And so I don't think it is always an issue of resources. To an extent, I think it's often an issue of how neuropsychology is taught and incorporated into clinical psychology training, considering that clinical psychologists are the only profession who can do these sorts of cognitive assessments. The fact that, you know, most clinical psychologists, and this is not purely my judgment, when I do training, frequently clinical psychologists mention to me, I just don't feel confident doing it. I haven't done one for years. I avoid doing them. I mean, it's, you know, no one would lead clinical psychology, to use the same example, not feeling very confident doing straightforward risk assessments.
I wondered, Vaughan, because I have a similar experience of having conversations with people who've conducted a cognitive assessment, and often there's an array of numbers, and I'll say, what do these numbers tell me? And I'll say, well, the numbers on their own aren't going to tell you anything, right? So what was the question that you thought these numbers were answering? I wondered if the bit that's often missing in terms of people's thinking is actually being able to consider cognition. Right, it's not so much the assessment, but what do you know about someone's cognition? What do you know about their memory, or their attentional functioning, their general levels of ability? And I think that the way that training has become somewhat dichotomized in terms of clinical psychology and neuropsychology has been that cognition has fallen out. So we think of neuropsychology as being testing, and we think of clinical psychology as being very mental health focused, and yet they're kind of that sort of bread and butter, being able to ask people questions about their cognitive strengths and weaknesses, is something that's not necessarily very well founded in our repertoire as clinical psychologists. So would you agree with that? So I often try to emphasize in having these conversations, how might you ask someone about their memory in a way that reflects the underlying architecture of our memory systems? How might someone describe having a poor memory in a way that would pique your interest about them possibly having a memory disorder? Because I think one of the things that's very difficult without any training is to know what's the threshold for doing an assessment. And so, as you pointed out, that in some people, that the extent and breadth of cognitive impairment might be evident from speaking to someone about their everyday difficulties. And so there is correspondingly limited value in doing an assessment if all you're trying to do is to demonstrate that what they're saying is valid. I mean, there might be some value in that, but we can learn a lot from talking to people, can't we, about their cognition, about their cognitive experience.
Yeah, and not just through their answers, exactly how, you know, how you mentioned how people answer the question, because as we know, you know, one of our kind of important foundational facts is that people's subjective cognitive complaints are not a good guide to actually how their cognition is. And so that doesn't mean we ignore people, we take people seriously, but what it means is we can't just ask people, how's your memory? Yeah, it's fine, great, problem solved. And so, you know, actually, you know, how people answer, how we talk to people about these things, what other information we need, to, you know, other people's opinions, you know, absolutely crucial. And to understand that, for example, we need to have a good understanding, for example, of how different sorts of difficulties can impact on your experience and knowledge of your own memory. And you know, that's a real kind of crucial skill, right, in terms of, particularly in terms of different sorts of neurological difficulties. And it's not necessarily the case that you need to have an in-depth knowledge, but it also applies to psychiatric difficulties. We know that, for example, in older people, subjective memory complaints are a better guide to someone having depression than they are to someone having neuropsychological difficulties with their memory. And this sort of thing pops up a lot. And the more you kind of, you know, investigate this, the more you understand that there's an important and essential interaction between people's mood, stress, trauma, you know, and so on, and cognition. And it goes in both directions. And our job is not to, you know, have a memory thermometer. Blood test psychology, as my friend Jorge calls it, right? You just get a bunch of numbers out. Actually, what psychologists should be doing is understanding all of this complexity and helping someone solve a problem that's causing them difficulties.
It's a lot easier for us to teach people how to do a blood test, right? It's a lot more time efficient. We can teach someone how to do a memory test, a list learning test. You know, those skills are relatively straightforwardly acquired, aren't they? It's much more difficult to do the kind of thing that you're describing, which is to have a background in understanding memory systems, in understanding how people report subjective experience and how that's fraught with all kinds of biases, I suppose. But we need to be able to cut through that and come to a formulation which includes cognition in some way. But that requires quite detailed and subtle and sophisticated training, doesn't it? I suppose that's what you're suggesting we need, right?
And do you know what, though? That's what we get, right? We get detailed and nuanced training about a whole range of things. It's just interesting that it rarely involves neuropsychology. It's always a different part of the syllabus, and it's still the case that a lot of our neuropsychology training, even on a clinical psychology level, is taught as if it is about a different population of people, and a lot of the, you know, training documents for clinical neuropsychology are still very clear that this is about neurological patients. And so from both sides, I think it is a case of just coming to an understanding that actually this is not an optional specialization. There may be some optional and specialized things, but of course there is in everything. I mean, there's much to learn about PTSD and trauma that you don't learn on training and won't learn in other services. And yet nobody goes through training going, wow, you know, this trauma thing is just not for me. It's a bit too complex. I don't think it's relevant. You know, I don't see myself doing it. And yet that is the attitude we've often had for you know, neuropsychological approaches.
You touched on earlier on the sort of service structure. I think what you were saying is that we don't necessarily need a revolution in the way that services are structured. You're not saying we need to dismantle neuro rehab services. We need to pull neuropsychology out of neurosciences centers where it does exist and place it somewhere else, so it's kind of more accessible. But we do need to think about the lack of accessibility of some of our services to those with mental health problems. Is that, and that doesn't have to be a dismantling necessarily. These could be, they're challenging, but they could be subtle tweaks, couldn't they, to the training and the disposition of various services to accommodate individuals with mental health histories.
Absolutely. And, you know, if we think of trauma-informed care, and of course there are debates about trauma-informed care, and I kind of have mixed feelings about it. I've never met anybody who doesn't think they're doing trauma-informed care, interestingly enough, despite the fact that clearly there must be some, you know, additional knowledge and kind of framing involved. But I really like the idea that some additional knowledge, training, understanding of the impact of trauma is understood as, no, you don't have to work in a trauma clinic. Mm-hmm. You can inform your work wherever you work with an understanding of trauma. And if we had neuropsychologically informed care, I think that would be a better model than trying to either make everybody a neuropsychologist or to, you know, make people feel slightly inadequate because they're not a neuropsychologist. Actually, neuropsychologically informed care is probably what we should be, you know, aiming for, just because it's, you know, important and helpful and is accessible to clinical psychologists wherever they work.
Well, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I would, I'm sure that anybody listening would be interested in pursuing these ideas further, hearing about what you've said. We'll make sure the link to your lecture is out with alongside this podcast. But I just really wanted to thank you for speaking so openly and about what is actually quite a difficult and challenging area, I think, for all of us. And I guess particularly if you're working there, Vaughan, and acting as an advocate for change, it's like strikes me that there's a sort of campaigning voice in there somewhere, is there?
Yeah, you know, and part of that campaigning voice is not to wag my finger, it's to invite people in, you know. And I hope a lot of what I'm doing is trying to convince psychologists who would not previously think of themselves as a neuropsychology person just to go, do you know what, this is important, this will help me and help the folks I work with, and is not more intimidating, difficult, abstract than anything else I do.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks. Very kind of you.